CliffCentral.com.
All right, time to get stuck into something a little more interesting, perhaps, than some of the things going on socially in South Africa, and that is the issues around state capture, the issues around what technology can bring to this. I've got Dr. Terence Kamal here. He's a member of YPO. He's a speaker. He's an author. He's a medical doctor, entrepreneur, strategist, and a CEO. You've got such a big CV, it's very difficult to actually get to. I mean, how do you fit all that on a card? Like, what do people call you?
Amazingly, thanks for having me, guys. I literally leave it blank. I put Terence Kamal. And that's actually, there's no designation on that card.
You don't even put doctor.
I do it for some cases.
I think you have to, because it's a lot of your life that you've dedicated to that. It's not something small. A medical doctor is not just nobody.
Yeah, especially in this country, it takes a very long time to get
there. Plus, of course, if you're on a plane or somewhere and then they go, is there a doctor in the house? You have to be able to say, yes, it's
amazingly,
me.
I've actually had that.
What?
Especially
what
long haul flights.
Yeah.
I had two Emirates flights flying via Dubai.
Yeah.
And it's probably 2 a.m. You've had a few drinks in the flight because you want to relax on your way there.
Uh-oh.
And the air hostess wake you up. Sorry, sir. Are you a medical doctor or some other doctor? I'm like, I am. But, there's this child. And then very quickly you forget you had a whiskey in between. Because you literally go back into automatic mode.
Yeah.
Whatever it was, we fixed him up.
So was it a kid who'd something went wrong?
I think it was an allergic reaction or something that happened. And thank God they looked at the manifest and went through. So I didn't even know they actually go in that much detail.
Wow.
But they just looked,
you don't carry around a pharmacy in your bag. So what do they expect you to do? I mean, an allergic reaction you need to treat with, antihistamines or something.
Luckily, I did have basic antihistamines.
Oh, you did?
That I traveled with.
Shit.
Regrettably.
What are you going to bag? Someone go and get Dr. Terence's bag. Let's have a look through that right now. What
especially
you
when you travel internationally, you want to have your basics with you. So I usually have stuff on me. It's just an old habit. That you've got some basics available.
Lucky for the kid.
Luckily for him.
And then what happens after? Do they upgrade your next flight?
Amazing. We were on business anyway.
Do you invoice them?
That would be nice of them, because you've solved a problem that they couldn't solve. They should they should technically pay up with at least a nice free international flight or something.
I wish. I don't think they're that generous.
So listen, you're an interesting guy, and you've done quite a lot of interesting things. Let's just look at this. 18 years of experience in various industries. You're passionate about things like blockchain, artificial intelligence, healthcare, networking, leadership development, and family. And you've led teams in startups, family businesses, and even national and international multi-million dollar entities. You also are a former member of the presidential medical team, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is very, very interesting stuff. You don't look old enough to have done all of this.
I think it's been a diverse career. Literally, when I started out, my life, like a lot of people out there in this day and age, I started with scholarships.
Right.
So we came up from very trying circumstances.
Yeah.
And I studied on scholarships. I joined the military. I had scholarships to study medicine and actuarial science at various institutions.
Huh. But that both? You got scholarships for medical science and actuarial science?
Yes.
Good.
I wasn't a sports guy, as you figured, so.
Well, I mean, you must have had incredible marks. What sort of school marks did you have?
I think it's been a while, but if I recall properly, I think I finished on a 94 aggregate.
Jesus.
Okay.
Yeah, I was one of those really hardworking, did nothing
in school. I'm impressed with that. And then you had to choose between the two, right? Because you can't be an actuary and a medical doctor. Your brain will explode.
I was completely at that point, like most kids in school, you're not sure what you want to do.
But everybody wants their kid to be a doctor.
They do, but axi was the buzzword. Everybody wanted to do actuarial science.
Oh.
And every single person you heard of that was getting good results was doing actuarial science. We didn't know what they did, but it sounded really cool.
You also like artificial intelligence. Do you think that actuarial science is one of those areas that's ultimately going to become a machine area? I mean, I think machine learning and all the rest of it's going to eventually put those actuarial scientists out of work.
I think so. Currently the bulk of is they set up their formulas.
The irony is that the people who get the highest marks now are going to be out of jobs within the next maybe 10 years. It's going to take a while, but these are the smartest people, and now they're going to find themselves, ironically, replaced by machines.
Yes. And, you know, recently I've been giving advice to a lot of kids that I mentor and assist, and I had a child who is now, she's 15, 16, and said, what do I need to study? I said, do science, because you need science to get into most degrees. Do mathematics and accounting, because that's going to hold you in good stead. It's just logical sciences. And she said, what else do I do? I said, go do something like geography.
Mm.
She said, but why would I do something I don't like? I said, well, start to like it, because it's an easy A.
Well, yes, but also, you know, you've got to be able to, because things are changing so fast, dance in a moving car, but you need to know a lot about all kinds of things. You need to be a generalist.
Yeah.
But I think what makes it interesting in your case is that you are a specialist in that you are a doctor, which takes a huge amount of effort and time. And that has to do with people, but it's also a science.
Yeah.
And then you've done all this stuff in business too. So just go back to your story. You said trying circumstances. Yeah. I really appreciate the fact that you don't go into some long sob story because nobody cares.
Yeah.
Exactly. Is what people, I mean, these days, nobody really is interested in someone suffering unless it makes them feel better about their lack of suffering.
Indeed.
That's just how people are. But you did kind of breeze past it. So give me a little bit of detail there.
Sure. I think growing up, my father was a school teacher when we were growing up,
mm-hmm.
and teachers' salaries aren't the best.
No.
It used to be a very glamorous job in the old days,
mm-hmm.
and amazingly, I have immense respect for the people that I learned under my teachers.
Absolutely.
And in this day and age, it's a very different dynamic. Kids have no respect, and it's a different perspective.
Mm.
But a teacher's salary wasn't the best, and we grew up, and it reached a point where my mother had to go to work to assist with the family expense, and this was in sort of the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And when you reach that point where you're literally living to pay off the bond and pay off the basics, it really motivates you to do more. And when I finished school, I had this grand dream, and it was free to dream at that point, is I told my mother, when I reach 30 years old, I'm going to give you a bank card and you're never going to have to look at a price again and you can just take what you need. And she says, yeah, one day. I was a year late. At 31, I reached that point. But when you come from a sense of you want to create value of legacy for yourself and your family, it changes the dynamic. And that is how I started my career in the military, because they had offered the best scholarship. So you literally spend a year with them.
Yeah.
And it's not the, for want of a better word, not this play soldier thing that they have recently, because currently you have a lot of colleagues, and I know of business friends. Every business meeting they walk into, you know, I was a soldier. I'm like, actually, you really weren't. You worked in the military. It didn't make you a soldier. Because when you get people who join us, professionals in the military, they would do a two-week crash course in the basement showing you which hand to serve.
No, there's no active duty.
No active duty. And you work in a hospital or a professional environment.
And I heard the other day that an average soldier in South Africa is 42 years old, overweight, overpaid, and not particularly effective on the battlefield.
I don't know, since we're not fighting too many battlefields, but...
No, certainly not. We don't have any existential threat as a military sovereign state.
Indeed.
But if we were attacked by, let's say, a slightly more organized band of militia, we'd have a big problem.
Yes. I think we're well equipped.
But when you were in there, it was quite an organized, well-oiled machine.
Yes, and one of the reasons I actually left is that organized machines started to fall apart.
When
I joined in 2000, 2001, we're talking a 13, 14-year period. It started to come off because there were too many pulls of power. And that links, to the discussion of state capture that we can traverse later.
Mm.
But there were too many pushes and pulls, because when there was what they called the CODESA negotiations, the pre-94 settlements, they had put in something called a sunset clause, which some people are aware of and some don't. But the practical implication was some jobs or particular groups of people were protected for the next 20 years. Which meant by the time we were coming to 2014, the protection would fall away.
Mm-hmm.
So the World Cup came at the perfect time, because then things were being done in the military and state institutions purportedly for the World Cup that were actually meant to break the system to create value for those who were coming to pension. And I along the way, I spent time in the environment saying, hold on, what's going on? The military offers phenomenal scholarships. They offer scholarships in professional domains. My brother trained as an engineer in the Air Force. They offer healthcare training, so everything across the board. It took a long time to transform, because I was one of the first people of color that actually got into the program. But ironically, even still in 2000-2001, the black students had to go to Medunsa and the white students to Pretoria, to Tuckies.
Wow. Still then.
So it didn't transform, and we had to fight our way through. And when you're the first few guys fighting, you can become very unpopular very quickly with the powers that be. And I said, but guys, this needs to stop. This entitlement needs to fall away. Because you used to have colleagues where black students are obligated in the campus holidays to work because you're getting paid a military stipend, almost a mini salary. But the colleagues of a different demographic would be on holiday, fill in a leave form that's never used. As long as nothing happens, they marked present as if they came to work and just carry on. So I started to experience that at
sheltered
a very early
employment.
Stage. Yeah. It was. It was a very protectionist environment, which currently is transforming.
Mm-hmm.
But the price we paid is those who were leaving the system at that point broke the system. That's why Mandela had to go to a private hospital and not the military hospital. One military wasn't as well equipped as it was when I got there.
Yeah, that worries me because if you can't look after your soldiers and you can't look after your president from a medical point of view, how well do the ordinary people have, you know, any hope of achieving some level of health security?
Yes.
And I'm curious, when you're on the presidential medical team, what did that involve and when were you on there?
I was on what they call the extended presidential medical team. This was during the World Cup period.
Okay.
So a period of about 2-3 months in which they obviously had their regular team that protected our head of state. Mm-hmm. But when you've got now 40-50 different heads of states coming across, we were then invited, people who were military trained, so you're combat trained. And then I had led the training with the American Defense Force for South Africa in disaster management and planning. So they said, hey, Terrence, you're the right guy. Get out of the hospital. We're going to take you across. And in reality, it's not as glorious as it sounds. It sounds nice that you worked for the heads of states and presidents.
That's quite important.
As even as an officer from the military, you are subservient to a policeman who's far your junior because they control the security detail. You're just a tag along to make sure nothing really happens. And if something happens, you're there. It was interesting initially. It was very glorious because you had key events and key invitations with your principals. But then you'd get particular heads of states without mentioning their names who'd be partying till 5 a.m. And you've got to sit in the car and wait till they come into a stupor and make sure they're okay for the next day.
It's unbelievable.
So I think it was a great place to be. It's nice to say you've done it and put in your CV perhaps and mention it. But that was my original goal when I joined the military. Besides having a great scholarship program, I said one day I'm going to get to the top of the log on the system. I'm going to serve the president. When I reached that, I'm like, what next? And then I trained in anesthesia or anesthetics. And I think a week before graduating, I resigned because there's nothing left in the organization.
Oh, really? You did work on the board of the Road Accident Fund.
Correct.
Now, that's a mess and a half. You got to explain to me what it looks like from the inside, because all we hear about it is that it's constantly running out of money. Lawyers use it as a football between each other. The government is constantly hiking the petrol price to be able to fund this goddamn thing. What's going on there?
Well, I don't know now, but now it sounds like a worse off mess than at least a 2-year period that I was with them.
When were you there?
I was there right till the end of June this year.
Okay.
So I spent a significant time with them. They tell you it's non-executive, but if they're mailing you 5 times a day, you're spending most of your professional time giving them input and interactions. The biggest challenge you find with the Road Accident Fund is they are strategic, optimistic abuses of the process. Not just from the lawyers, and that's what a lot of people believe, it's the lawyers and doctors milking the system.
Mm.
Yes, the reality is there's a microeconomy around the attorneys,
mm-hmm.
and also in what they call the healthcare providers or provide services.
Yeah.
But when I got to the board, some of the fundamentals of governance were missing. And so, but I can't, as the Institute of Directors say, I can't tell you the confidential stuff that we discussed.
Sure. No.
But structurally, it was the only place that I found a chairman in state sector, even beyond the one from SAA, who was in his third appointment as chairperson of the same institution. It's unheard of, even in best practice in private institutions, unless you're a privately held company, for the same guy to be at the top for 3 years, because there's always the risk of it becoming a little fiefdom.
Yeah, of course.
Which, when I got there, it started to look like that, because you say, but this is best practice, and he says, this is how we do it. There were some practices, and this is not board confidential, it's public domain. They had created what they call a chairperson's committee. He says he inherited it, but also his charter director, and the perception would be is he would follow best practice. But they had a chairperson's committee, which was the chair, the vice chair, and the 4 subcommittee chairs,
mm-hmm.
which was 6 of the 10 votes,
mm-hmm.
which would only meet 1 hour before the main board meeting. There would not be an agenda. There would not be minutes. In my mind, this was a caucus committee.
Wow.
They knew what decisions were coming, and they would pre-plan it.
And already plan their votes around it.
Yes. And the biggest thing that
didn't matter what the other 4 of you did.
To a large extent, yes.
Jesus.
I fought a lot of things, and that's one of the key reasons Minister Nzimande now eventually acted to take actions on some of the members of the board.
Mm-hmm.
What frustrated me is he didn't really go as far as holding them accountable. And hopefully one day soon enough that the board members involved will be held accountable, because there was manipulation of – because currently there's an acting CEO. The interference of the CEO process, which is documented, also took place under our watch, and I was the only one that refused to allow it to happen. Because literally there was interference with the process. There were particular board members that said, I want this person, and they did what they could to get their person to get the job. And I said, I'm not going to sign this.
It seems like the priorities are all wrong, though, because someone has to be appointed here and someone's after a job there and someone's after a cushy salary or sheltered employment or whatever it might be. But actually, we've got a major problem in South Africa. And when we talk about the Road Accident Fund, we should be addressing why so many people die on South Africa's roads.
Correct.
That seems to me to be the real issue.
I don't think the Road Accident Fund can change that, Gary.
But did you guys talk about this kind of thing? Because it costs us a fortune.
Yes.
To pay out claims from the Road Accident Fund. A lot of people die in South Africa because they're pedestrians.
Yes.
I mean, these are preventable deaths.
I think they definitely are preventable. But I don't think the Road Accident Fund's mandate is to manage that. That comes from the road departments and the provinces.
No, sure. It's the Ministry of Transport, if anything. But the Road Accident Fund, you must look at those balance sheets and think, this is crazy. We shouldn't have to be doing this. Why are so many people either very, very irresponsible drivers, very irresponsible pedestrians?
Yes.
And why are these unnecessary deaths so high in South Africa when in countries that potentially have far more cars, they have far less accidents?
I don't have an answer, Garrett, to be honest.
I know, but
I don't have an answer.
Doesn't it bother you like it bothers me?
I think the biggest thing that frustrated me is we had one job at the Road Accident Fund, and I was a significant provider before I got to the board. That was never concealed at any stage. But what frustrated me the most is the people that are the beneficiaries, or the due beneficiaries, are the most maimed, disabled, impaired, and people need the support. But when
We're talking about someone who can't walk ever again because of a road accident.
Correct.
That wasn't their fault, and they get it sounds like a lot, but they get R1 million or whatever. That's not going to help them fix their lives if they can never walk again.
I think the sad reality of that process is it's become a financial model. You can put what they call functionality or impairment linked to a number, and that's how the industry is built at the moment.
It's like the Paralympics. No, it is, because they say, this is the C7 hurdle race. And you're like, well, what the fuck's a C7? I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that system, right?
I think that the challenge with that is it's become the microeconomy, which is where the problem is. Because it becomes self-funding in terms of what you can do and what you can benefit.
Yeah.
Especially from the attorney side and those involved in that entire environment, which is really frustrating because what I've seen all too often, and no one's done anything to fix it, both from the fund or the other side, is in 8 out of 10 cases, you're going to find a lawyer who's going to find a psychologist who says the patient alleges he lost consciousness for whatever amount of period, or he can't remember, or he can't recall. There's not always concrete evidence to support that.
Right.
But they insist that the plaintiff, in most cases, will insist, well, the psychologist must put a line, funds to be protected, because the person has cognitive challenges. What that essentially means is the lawyer takes his 25%, gets all his costs for his experts, and because the psychologist said the funds be protected, he then brings a curatorship application to the court, which says my friend or person X will become the curator for the 75%.
Wow.
So literally
that's
the client
crooked.
Gets nothing. And then they would get, I've seen cases where the claimant gets R1,000 a month. He's as good as being on SASSA on a $2 million payout, but the lawyer and his group of people will take 20,000 to administrate.
Isn't there an argument here that actually this is a terrible idea, kind of like the national health insurance is a terrible idea? Maybe you think it's a good idea. I don't know. We haven't spoken about that yet. But that people should be responsible for themselves.
I think so.
I mean, the state is never the best parent.
I think internationally, best practices, and it's in most established countries, where you've got to have your own insurance, your own third-party insurance. So when you have your license disc, you have your insurance displayed.
Correct.
That is the solution. It was there in the country previously. It needs to be there again.
I mean, if you want to own a car or if you want to navigate our public transport systems or use our roads,
yes,
you need to make sure that you're safe.
Yes.
And a part of that is paying a small amount every month towards an insurance which will protect you if something goes wrong.
Yes. But what we also need to be cognizant of, and something that I'm really concerned, is we're the only country in the world where you could have an illegal immigrant or person who purports to here on an immigration status or whatever the circumstance. If they here legally and the government has documented you're here, you own an asylum permit, I have no issue because then the state takes ownership
of
your responsibilities. But there's a large volume of people who illegally cross the border will get bumped by a car and then sue the state for damages.
And they can?
They can, and they do. Because I've raised it multiple times in reports saying, as a doctor, when I used to see patients or still see patients, I want your identity. How are you here and where's your permit? Because the Immigration Act says no professional will assist any person with professional services unless you can prove he's here validly in the country. Mm. And you call up the lawyer and the lawyer says, doctor, that's not your job, it's the courts. And frankly, the court doesn't care either. Whether he's here legally or not is not your problem.
Does he have
an injury? Just treat him.
And that means you also have to treat criminals that are illegal immigrants.
I don't mind the treatment. This is the claim portion.
No, I'm totally. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, wow, this is just insane.
I've actually seen a lady come in.
That must incur huge, huge, huge costs for us.
It's phenomenal amounts of money. But they know the system well. Ironically, they're professionals who will do it and come in and say, I got bumped by a car.
But
this is
on.
What I got.
This is almost like those, you see these videos of people in certain countries who know that they can get a claim this way, and they actually pretend, or they get themselves into dangerous situations where they can hurt themselves very badly and perhaps even get killed just so that they can get a claim.
Yes. I think that currently exists.
See, that's providing a very bad motivation for people, if you ask me.
Yes. But because it's such a lucrative environment,
you've
and how much
people jumping in front of cars because they want to get 100 grand. No, really.
I've actually seen cases where you see witness or patients give the affidavit to the police, the accident report. The patient will tell you, I was standing at 6:15 a.m. waiting for my transport to work in a north-south direction. Traffic was going east-west. I saw a Tata vehicle model 2630 coming at me with license plates XYZ. It hit me. I'm like, if you had that much time, why didn't you just get out of the way? But they literally stand there and they, but you can see in that case, it's the lawyer who probably doctored that affidavit to put in as much detail, because the law says you must identify the vehicle. If it's a hit and run, you've only got 2 years to claim. If it's an identified vehicle, you've got 3 years. So this poor claimant just signs what he's told to say. Yeah. But when you look at it, it's ludicrous.
Jesus, I mean, it's got to be a better system than this.
I think the system has to improve. The push for RABs, I think their benefits and are their challenges to the new system they want to bring in.
Okay.
Which will mean patients get paid a monthly stipend or get paid regularly, almost like a COIDA or workman's compensation claim, which has some benefit, where the state will say, well, you have X amount of loss. The challenge I have is they've put a ceiling to it. But let's assume somebody's injured and you pay them regularly for what they lost for that period, and you rehabilitate regularly. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Because the current system is flawed. Because the bulk of those funds, let's assume you claim for medical costs and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Once the lawyer takes his 25%, you're already shortchanged on what you need.
Oh.
And the lawyers are fighting it, one, because they believe they can do great justice. But the reality is, the biggest reason they're fighting is you're destroying an entire industry that they found very lucrative. So the fight is not always about the patient will benefit.
No, sure.
The fight is also about self-sustenance.
All right, but I didn't bring you here to just talk about the Road Accident Fund because you're not involved there anymore.
Indeed.
So what about NHI? I mean, you're in an interesting position, and this is something I presume there are not a lot of people who are positioned like you are to be able to comment about this quite objectively, sure. Because you are a medical professional, but you're also someone who's been involved in business, and you're someone who's been involved in the state.
Yes.
So you have an interesting, I would imagine, perspective on all of this. Yes. When Aaron Motsoaledi talks about the NHI, and we've got state hospitals which are largely dysfunctional, you know, I always joke with people, and it's not very funny, but it's still worthy of the title joke, that you are likelier to get sicker and die if you go to a state hospital than you are to get better. And I mean, that's a glib way of looking at things, but it's in very many cases the situation for a lot of people. You wait, there's super bugs, there isn't the required resource in terms of staff or equipment or space. So for many people, it is a bit of a death sentence.
I agree and disagree, Gert, and I'll tell you why. If you look at some of the key facilities in the country, and I'll give you some of the key names, Steve Biko, Colifong, and others that I've trained and worked at, if I was sick today, I'd want to go there.
Oh.
Because you got to understand how these systems work, especially the academic kind of settings or facilities within the academic circuits, as they call it. When you get admitted, a junior doctor would see you. He'd call in a senior doctor. He'd then call it a registrar. He reports to a professor or reports to a head of department.
Mm-hmm.
Every day after an admission round,
you're getting five
opinions, and you're getting oversight of what goes on.
Right.
In private, you've got a guy chasing numbers and targets.
Yeah.
And he's going to get there and clock you in at that casualty if you go for an emergency. But 9 out of 10 times, those guys are locums, as they call it.
Yes.
He's not an employee of the hospital. He's a freelancer. He pitches up, he provides a service, he admits what he can, and everybody's happy. When you get into that ward in a private hospital today, probably more than 60 to 70% are moonlighting nurses. They don't belong to that hospital. They come in, they provide a service for a fee, and they're gone. I know personally, my mum was in a step-down facility at Mill Park, which is considered a very premium institution, in which The step-down facility from ICU meant every room is manned by a professional nurse.
Yeah.
And she has assistant or auxiliary nurses to support her. To cut costs, they had one professional nurse overseeing 10 rooms and junior nurses administering patients. My mother had a heart attack or cardiac arrest post-bypass, which was practically impossible.
Yeah.
And the cardiothoracic surgeon got in, and the next day we only figured what was going on. The junior nurse, who's not trained to put up medicines, she's meant to do the basic functions, was plugging a little IV line into the bottle, plugging into the patient, and it was going to open. But that entire line was filled with air, causes an emboli.
Which is horrendous. That can kill people.
In private facilities. And the reality is, if you were to then look at it for a review and say, but hold on, are patients dying after bypasses? The answer would be yes. But are they dying because of complications or professional negligence is a different matter. But the NHI model, I think, is... Will the minister achieve what he wants as NHI in principle as it stands? As people say, well, you're gonna go out to a hospital. I think Professor Bull Shao from Harvard School of Public Health that I've done training with put it very succinctly when he spoke to the deputy minister. He says, you're not building an NHI, you're building an NHS. NHS model or a national health service means you must go to a state facility and we'll make sure we give you services at minimal or no cost. NHI means you get a card. An insurance kind of entitlement. You could take that where you wanted to. Whether you go down the road to Sandton or you go down to something in Cape Town or in Pretoria, you choose your facility. Insurance means the state will pay no matter where you go. But this ideal clinic model is built towards building the state system. I think where the minister's going, which is a good reality, is a large amount of the money that's in the private space is being abused. Because there is something called PMBs. Which a lot of people may or may not be aware of, but it's prescribed minimum benefits.
Mm.
So if you were to go to hospital, and I can tell you factually, I've got colleagues who do it and I don't agree with it. If you went to a physician at Hospital X in Pretoria and you needed a workup because you had a hospital plan, they would say, don't worry, we're going to admit you. And they'd put a diagnosis, chest pain, which means potential myocardial infarction, straight into ICU, 2 days in ICU, 2 days in high care, 6 days in the general ward.
Mm-hmm.
But that was only so they could work you up because you didn't have the money to pay for the testing and for the angiogram and stuff just because you think you might need it. The physician makes money. The hospital loves it because they have an almost unwritten protocol in some facilities. If the hospital gives the doctor the room, he will admit regularly. But those funds are the funds that belong to those medical aid or the hospital fund. Those funds are being abused by corrupt professionals. Just pure greed, to put it very bluntly. Those funds, the minister is saying, if we were to pool all our resources together, we could create better services.
Well,
so I think it's a noble principle.
I don't know, though, because, first of all, that money is not his.
Correct, but it still belongs to the people who are paying those funds.
Yes, but that's not his, and I don't want him to administer my money. No. This is a very straightforward thing,
yeah.
And I don't believe that the state is necessarily the best way of running this system, because they've proven time and time again that they can't run systems extremely well, especially in health. And health should be an individual decision. You should have a relationship with your doctor. You should be able to choose whatever insurance company you decide to go with. And you should also be able to then, within all of that, be able to choose more or less where you'd like to be treated and
how. I fully subscribe to that. I think his principle is a very broad, altruistic perspective, but I agree with you 100%.
No, it's not
altruistic.
It's social engineering. It's not.
Yep.
It's the horrendous philosophy.
I think they've...
Dangerous.
That's the way they package it.
Yes, but again, who's going to pay for all of this? If we take all of this money that he's talking about, he just sees money because he's a politician. He sees money and he says, how can I get my greedy paws on that? How can I get this into the clutches of bureaucrats? Rather than how I'm not allowed to touch someone else's property. And apart from that entirely, I don't know necessarily that they've got a great track record for showing how well they can administer this whole thing.
I agree with you. I think the ambitious focus of trying to get something done is not matched by having the resources to what they say they want to do.
But even if we have the resources that he says we have, there's still a huge gap that needs to be filled.
100%.
That gap is billions of rands.
Yeah.
Where are we going to get that from? We can't milk the taxpayer even more. They're pretty much at capacity.
It looks like that's the intention. Milk us again. The haves will fund the have-nots, which is the
haves don't have that much more anymore.
I agree.
That's the problem. I think he thinks it's a bottomless pit because he's never been in business.
I agree. I think the model has a lot of challenges. That is why it took so long for what they called the white paper to come out of what they think they're going to do. But there's still no clear answer of how we're going to fund this thing.
Nah.
Where's the money going to come from?
No, because they'll just borrow. That's what governments do.
And we probably pick up the tab.
Well, we do, whether we like it or not. Yep. Again, and then future generations will be saddled with the debt of this one. It's not a fair way.
Like we all pick up the tab for the recent meaning last 10, 15 years of mismanagement of various entities also.
Yeah. I mean, we had to pick up the tab for Adani Mahlangu killing those people in Life Esdemeni, for example. Yeah. All right. So a couple of other things I want to talk to you about. Sure. What is YPO and how are you involved there?
Sure.
I've heard a lot about Young Presidents Organization. I've heard a lot of very, very complimentary things. I've heard that this is a great place for people to network, to form business communities, to learn things, to share ideas.
Yes. YPO stands for Young Presidents Organization. It's originally a US-based organization. It's now a global organization. It was built when the thinking was, when you're head of an organization, it gets lonely. There are things that you need to discuss about yourself, your family, and your business that you couldn't take to other environments. So the fundamental or the basic of it is what they call a forum, or almost a private boardroom. So you'd get peers in a room, which is typical in South Africa and internationally. You'd get 7 or 8 people in the same room forming a forum, which is a safe haven for that individual. You meet once a month. So you discuss things about yourself, your family and your life and your business concerns with trusted peers who may have very similar but different environment inputs and experiences.
Right. So it's almost like a, I don't want to say group therapy session, but it's kind of a place where you can go and you can have people who are in a similar position help you figure out how to be more efficient and perhaps get things right that are not necessarily aligned.
But that's on the micro space. That's your private space. Right. The global organization is leaders for leadership development. So you support and grow from each other because the principle is lifelong learning. As heads of organizations and businesses, you can't know everything. No. And you can't have the time to go learn everything yourself either. You've got to learn from someone who's been there. So the international organization is more than 25,000 members. You can connect to any peer around the world. And they've created what they called, as I call, forums and chapters. So I belong to the Pretoria and the Pan-Africa chapters. And they're chapters around the country and chapters across the globe.
There must be some fairly important people in this organization.
Significantly important.
And you can contact any of them?
According to the organization, yes. We have access to every single member's contact details, personal and professional.
Sheesh.
But that is why it's so strict to get in. Yeah. Because it's a safe haven of
How much do you have to have in the bank? Annual average assets of at least $260,000.
That's for financial firms. Mm. Financial firms would have to have $260 million US dollars under their management. So if you're an investment firm,
if you're a sales services manufacturing corporation, you have to have turnover that exceeds $13 million US dollars.
Correct.
It's big money.
I think it's very
It's not huge money. It's not like
it's huge.
You know,
it's phenomenal.
That's a lot of turnover. Yeah.
Yes. So therefore, very few get in terms of the technical, or what we call the quantitative criteria in South Africa. But there's also the qualitative aspect. You could be making billions. You could be from that notorious family in this country. And if your peers just don't like you, they're just not going to let you in.
Are you talking about the Zumas, the Guptas? Because it's hard to tell which notorious family you're talking
we
about.
We could include both of them. Yeah. But the reality is there is a qualitative aspect because it's a very safe place where you can network with like-minded people internationally and locally. Then there's training programs that you would set up. So you have what you call an education calendar in each chapter. So you do various learning programs and something they called only in YPO. So if you want to have access to a particular individual and pick their mind, we've spoken to people who are in the ratings agencies, the Reserve Bank, and leading particular businesses locally and internationally. You would get an only in YPO access. Because of the reach of your institution, you would be able to engage with those individuals. But then you also have formalistic programs. So there's JVs with Harvard, London Business School, and others.
That's terrific.
Which is nice because they have customized programs, which is unheard of elsewhere. So I went to London Business School now a year and a half, where you've only got 120 of your peers in a custom program for a week.
Amazing.
So it's like-minded people learning from like. To me, it's been invaluable. The membership fees and the time you contribute. But like with any organization, as much as you put in is what you're getting.
Right, of course. Sounds pretty damn interesting. So what are you up to at the moment?
I think at the moment I'm still strongly involved in a lot of leadership development. I've launched a podcast now about 6 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
On ethical leadership and business and governance. Because I think there's a big need to bring that drive forward again on sharing experiences of what's happening in business environments and what needs to happen in the country. Very recently, I just had a chat with my very well-respected colleague, Kamokelo Mutlana, Bala World Logistics, who's a very bright mind and somebody I respect immensely. And we were talking about it just this week about how, you know, and advice to younger professionals And how their view is, they want to jump companies so they can have lots of experience. So when they put 10 companies on their CV, they believe they've arrived. But the logic from senior management is saying, hold on. They want to see the breadth of your experience. Mm. How much can you do within an organization? And then the depth of your knowledge in that environment. Because the fact that you've scratched the surface in 10 places doesn't mean you know enough to add value. So we those are the kind of discussions we're looking at. And also talking about discussions of what is true ethical leadership. Because in South Africa, the biggest challenge we sit with right now, and that's just my personal view, is the state capture, the capture of corporate institutions like the Steinhoffs and others, falls squarely at the feet of the auditors, because it's the auditing function that fails us in all of these environments. VBS Mutual Bank, the Deputy Reserve Bank Governor yesterday said they had signed off VBS's financials. How do auditors sign this off quarterly? But they get away with it scot-free, and that's where the challenge is. Because everybody has a perception that if the auditors have looked at it, it's clean.
It's legit, yeah.
But they don't understand, and you know, I've done an hour discussion on this previously, is auditing means a sampling. So an auditor walks in,
They're doing a dipstick test.
Dipstick test. Yeah. Literally a dipstick.
And that's not a diagnosis.
And you can literally skew the dipstick, because if you tell them that it's only 100.
If you did that as a doctor, you would be in dereliction of duty.
And it would be criminal sanctions and professional sanctions.
Absolutely.
In the audit space, there's very little sanctions, if any. I mean, they're going after Anuj Singh, and I don't think anything's happened to him either. Nothing's happened to the guys involved in a lot of the KPMG sagas or the other institutions.
Nothing ever happens. This is the land of irresponsibility. No, it really is. Nobody ever gets held to account.
Indeed.
Marcus Joost is still running around.
Yep.
Aidane Mahlangu, we spoke about earlier. No sanction there. She's still on the ANC's NEC for Gauteng. Mduduzi Manana, unless he'd resigned himself, they would never have got rid of him, and he actually beat a woman up in public.
But he resigned just because they were going to investigate.
The Guptas are still lording it over everybody and live in another country and have all the billions that they managed to pillage from us. Jacob Zuma's laughing all the time, even though he's going to court every now and then for a show trial. It's ridiculous. Nobody seems to ever be held responsible. Even KPMG, who took a big hit on the whole state capture thing, they're still in business.
Yeah.
Still doing things. They still got clients.
Yes.
There's no cost.
But I don't think it's KPMG alone. Because if you look at VBS, it wasn't KPMG.
No, of course not.
You look at Steinhoff, it was one of the other big four. Across the board, when you start to scratch a little past the surface, I had discovered when I was still with state institutions that the biggest critic of KPMG was another audit firm that said what they did is wrong. They had sat and served. Actually, one of their staff had acted as the internal auditor for the state institution. They were doing sole source procurement, which means they were flouting public tender processes to give themselves tenders that they audited and said was fine. And I looked at this and said, how do you do that?
This morning, I started the show saying that everybody has to start tidying what they can in their own backyard.
Indeed.
And that means if you know someone who's a crook and who's benefiting from some illegal government tender, you should out them.
Yes.
Because in the end, you're going to pay the price, not just, you know, the taxpayer at large. It's going to be you.
I think it's the legacy issue. And that's what, you know, I'm passionate about, is when you're being judged, and this is something I discussed with my peers recently, is when you make that decision, you need to ask yourself at that point, if your child was in front of you, would you be able to properly explain what you've done? And when it comes to the end of life, is that the legacy you want
to leave
behind?
What are you talking about? Parents lie to their kids all the time about Father Christmas and the Tooth Fairy.
But we're talking realistic issues. So you're talking to teen kids or adult kids and saying, listen, your son comes to you and says, Dad, how could you do this?
Yeah.
And he's going to – you
I mean,
can't
like I look
spend
at Brian Molefe, and I imagine – I mean, he has children. I imagine what they must think of their father. I wonder if they're embarrassed.
What I shudder to think is beyond Brian Molefe. Because some of those board members who sat on those boards are still on boards today.
Mm.
They're on other significant boards. They sit on the regulatory, self-regulatory institutions of this country. They sit on the SICAs and all the other bodies. They were there when they approved, as members of the audit committees and other committees, Malefe's payout. And when they got caught out, they approved his second payout. And we then say, these are the custodians of governance.
Yeah.
How do they talk to their kids?
Look, I mean, you know, you get the government you deserve. And maybe as South Africans, we also have to take a long, hard look in the mirror. This is something else that came up this morning in discussion and go, well, maybe we're a bunch of gullible idiots because the Guptas are way smarter than us. They came in here and they took everything away in wheelbarrows and now we go, oh, but woe is us. We've got to blame someone else. When you get taken advantage of like that over and over again, maybe the idiot's you.
very, very possible.
How can we allow these bodies that are meant to be the ones that give us an inkling of what the truth is?
Yes.
How can we allow them to keep on lying?
I agree. I think, Gareth, but we also got to look further beyond the Guptas. 100% I agree they were wrong.
But is this a leadership thing?
I don't think it's leadership. You've got to look at what are the, where's the power dynamic?
Mm.
Stanoff got away because of a particular geographic
but let's not, again, let's not blur the lines here. That's a private company. If you invested in them, sure, you've been you've lost a lot of value, but you knew you were investing in a private company, and there are risks in that. They don't always deliver profits. Sometimes they deliver corruption. But it's different with the state. Because the state is everybody, even poor people who aren't necessarily paying income tax. They're still part of the system and benefit only a little bit when it works. And it, to their detriment, they are hurt very badly when it doesn't.
Yes. I think, Gareth, we've also got to look at the biggest tipping point in my mind, and I may be completely wrong, was the Gupta's biggest mistake was interfering with the coal contracts. Mm. Because in this country, nobody
And landing at Waterkloof Air Force Base, or we probably would never have heard of them.
But amazingly, Gareth, they got away with the smaller stuff. If I put it in inverted commas, smaller stuff, if you follow me for a moment. But when things only became a problem when they started to interfere in the coal contracts of Eskom.
Mm-hmm.
All the other stuff they got away with, and the media made a moan about it but didn't take it too far. But when it became they interfered with what they call the evergreen contracts, because currently those coal contracts are permanently, particular interest groups have those contracts. If they, let's assume there's 36 contracts and the Guptas took two. Who is still controlling the other 34?
Oh, yeah, we should be looking.
And that's the value chain you got to ask. Who else was in – who did they upset – so far that they said, we're now going to shut you down. Because he was stealing a long time and nobody wanted to shut them down. It reached a point where they tipped something or someone and they said, it needs to stop.
Do we have any idea who those people are?
We have inclinations and suspicions, but it's old business and old money to a large extent that has those investments in place and says, but who are these boys ruffling our boat? Yes, they're corrupt, but does it make those who had those contracts for the last 30, 40 years less corrupt?
Yeah, I'm always blown away by the Eskom example. It's the worst example of how to run anything. It seems you've got a monopoly on something.
Yeah.
You're asking people to use less of your product, which goes against the grain of everything.
Yeah.
You're charging them more for less, and you're not delivering.
Yes.
And yet you still, despite all of that, run at a loss and end up being bailed out.
Yes.
It's just everything in that equation is like an alternate universe.
Yes. The most painful thing to me, Gareth, in when you look at the state institutions is not just the Eskoms and Transnets, because the biggest looting that actually happens, because I think it's actually being well orchestrated, the largest looting that's happening at the moment are the institutions that get clean audits that nobody's looking at.
Hmm.
Because if they say you got a clean audit, because the reality is the AG didn't audit those institutions. They gave it to KPMG. They gave it to Nkunki. I come off a board where the head of the audit committee was from Nkunki. And then you ask, if he's been there for the last 5 years, can we trust anything he did for the last 5 years? Because they made sure they got clean audits. There was a close link between the AG and the service providers. Mm. So those who have clean audits doesn't mean clean governance. Mm. And if there's no clean governance, things will come to the surface in the next couple of months that it's not just the Eskoms, it's not the Transnets, it's the ones who are just floating along very quietly.
Well, let's hope they come to the surface and let's find them and let's have some people held responsible.
Yes. I think it needs to happen. Besides the window dressing that's happening at the moment, because there are some cases they're saying they're pursuing, the state institutions are aware of a lot of the other cases. They're just very slow to act because you've got to understand the previous leadership, if I could call it, strategically placed people knowing their power is going to end. But particular people
deployment.
In charge of
key
institutions. And I won't mention them by name, but key investigation institutions.
Sure. Well, we know who they are. We know it's the NPA. We know it's various parts of the police. It's the hawks. It's all of these things.
Yes. So there is still that dragging your feet. Because I spoke to a colleague recently when they asked her for feedback for my time in government. And I discovered the person leading one of the key investigation institutions in South Africa was the head of a particular project that I had reported to be a corrupt project in excess of 200 million rand. And then you say, but hold on, is he ever going to investigate? And the honest answer, he's never going to touch it.
Of course not.
Because they were too close to it. But the power lies in civil society. Like we got the Sean Abrahams judgment out of the Concord, it's a very difficult time where civil society has to invest its own funds to make sure justice happens. But if we don't do it, nothing's going to change. So it's the Suzman Foundations, it's the Corruption Watches, the institutions that are taking these cases to court to make sure that justice prevails. It's a long, costly effort, not just from the financial side, but the burden on yourself, your family, your lifestyle, and everything else. But I think there's light at the end of the tunnel. It's a phenomenal country with phenomenal resources. If we can get this looting and this corruption and the state capture to stop. It's one of the best countries to live in if you, and I'm sure you've traveled extensively, still an amazing country with amazing people.
But it is harder for ordinary people to make a living.
It is.
Than it's been in a long time.
It has been. It's extremely difficult.
And I don't know that there are those resources anymore to help those NGOs to keep pursuing these things, because if you've got a 200 million rand illegal contract from somebody, you've got a lot more resources than, you know, 15 families who are just trying to scrape by and believe in justice.
I agree 100%. It's difficult. Even those who purportedly, as they call it, the middle class, everyone is struggling because things have just gone beyond the reach of the normal individual. And every time I walk out of a supermarket, I look at some of the people and say, but how are you making it through? I'm
not
slightly more comfortable.
They're not. They're living in debt. We know what happens in this country.
And it's a sad reality.
Yeah. So we've got to start with the little things, and at least, you know, there are initiatives that are starting to bear some fruit in this respect. I mentioned Begitele this morning and these cash and transit heists. He says that they've arrested 5 high-ranking policemen who they know were involved in this stuff. And we know that these rotten policemen exist, but now finally they're going after them.
Yes.
So it's little things, silver lining. Let's keep looking for them.
I think he needs to look a lot closer. There's a lot going on in his institutions also. Mm. The difficulty is when you're an executive head, like in the kind of position he has, he relies on a lot of information that comes to the system. And the reality is a large amount of it is filtered. They make sure he only gets to see what they want him to see.
Because there's been people who've been in various positions there for 10, 15 years.
Yes.
They're not going to let everything come.
He's got to start looking at simple things. Where's the value chain? Where does the money go? Besides the state, the environment, and I may have some intimate knowledge to it, but besides the money going into those specialized crime intelligence operative budgets, or those slush funds as they call it, where's the money going in the training environments?
Yeah.
Where's the money that when they do internal catering going to the facilities that have their little slush funds within the police colleges? That is where he needs to start looking.
All right. Well, that's all we got time for this morning, but it's a pleasure to meet you and to get to know you. You're a very, very interesting guy. I love your energy. I love the fact that you're doing things in so many different places and in so many different ways. And it's a great pleasure to spend some time with you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Terence Kamal, everybody. CliffCentral.com.